Hey.
Hey.
You got me?
I hear you, but I don't see you. Am I supposed to see
you? Why, let's see, FaceTime HD camera. Okay.
So you favor the floating head setting on the Zoom, I've noticed.
It's just what I have there. I don't really care.
It's become part of your look.
I know, it's my image. Now I'm the floating head. Somebody commented recently about the floating head, and I really, I took the position that that was the way to go, so I guess I have to defend it now.
Now I think it's, like I say, part of your identity, and that's how you do it, just consistency over time.
That might be a definition for identity.
Well, I think that positions us perfectly for what I want to read to you right now.
Oh, okay.
Actually, before we do that, let me just say, this is our annual birthday Third Story podcast episode, Ben Sidran turning 83 years old this year.
Or as I refer to it, my eighth annual 75th birthday, which is, I prefer.
Maybe it's your 53rd annual 30th birthday.
I like that too, yeah.
This year, here's what I have for you. You ready?
I hope so.
Buckle up. Ben Sidran is a musician to be reckoned with. And it's about time, at least in my opinion. His work combines the moods of Mose Allison with earthy, right-on-target lyrics. His piano playing is an inspired combination of Monk and Timmins. His voice can be earnestly sensual or irreverently funky and rough. And when he talks that talk, you'd best give a listen. Sidran admires Mose Allison's lyrics, quote, "'cause they're down to the bone." He says, "'I strive to make a statement that is absolutely sincere. I'm sure that I write songs for specific people, but basically I write them for myself, which sounds like an egocentric thing. I'm trying to solve my own problems, not anyone else's. It's my therapy." If Sidran's music is therapeutic, then it's a pleasure principle transposed to vinyl. Trouble is, his principles haven't reached universal proportions yet. But that doesn't really shake him up that much. He states, "I feel that I'm in the music business for the long run. And so I plan to be around for a long time. Actually, I'm in no hurry at all." Sidran has played piano since he was 7 years old back in Racine, Wisconsin. Quote, "I took lessons from a teacher down the street, but I've been fooling with the keyboard all my life, and for the last 10 years, quite seriously. I've been exposed to classical music, but it hasn't influenced me. I don't know why. As for the musicians I admire, the list is a long one, but it includes Bud Powell, Horace Silver, McCoy Tyner, and of course, Mose. I grew up on their music and later picked up on the Ray Charles, Southern Blues, and R&B, rather than the Philadelphia White Paul Anka junk. I was very serious when I was a young man and didn't really take street music seriously. To me, it was the garbage of the 50s, moron music. I was never knocked out by Jerry Lee Lewis the way my friends were. Rock and roll in that framework just doesn't make sense." It's obvious that Ben Sidran has no sense of nostalgia for the 50s. He grins and says, "I didn't know from DAs and hot rods. Jazz was my friend. I had every record that Blue Mitchell ever made. I knew him so well, I felt like he was my older brother. When I finally met him and got to play with him, it was like I was coming home. He had talked to me for so long, and finally now I got to answer back." Having jazz as a friend made growing up in the Midwest a little easier for Ben Sidran. "Racine had a very cold-blooded Protestant atmosphere," he says. "I grew up around people who were on trips of heavy denial of their emotions and pleasure. Music was considered to be backroom stuff. Also, the black population was suppressed. You forgot that 40% of the population was black. Things started branching out for me when I went to the University of Wisconsin and met a lot of players my own age from New York City. I met Steve Miller and made a lot of money playing with him, hanging out and getting laid, not necessarily in that order." He laughs and adds, "I learned a hell of a lot from Steve Miller. He made me play Charlena over and over until I understood it. A lot of jazz musicians have a technical facility only and tend to put down rock and roll and less complex music. Steve got me over that hurdle, and I acquired a new attitude." Meanwhile, Ben Sidran was still going to school. Quote, "People told me that I couldn't get a PhD and make records. Well, I went to the University of Sussex in England, and while I was working on my PhD, I recorded with Eric Clapton, Peter Frampton, Jesse Davis, and the Rolling Stones. I also produced records with my old friends Boz Scaggs and Steve Miller. I wrote my own songs and my own music. I never left school for music, and I never left music for school." He considers the irony of that statement for a moment and brings it all home. Quote, So I got my PhD in American Studies from the University of Sussex, but I got my real education at the University of Bob Dylan and Mose Allison. Ben's doctoral thesis evolved into a book called Black Talk, subtitled How the Music of Black America Created a Radical Alternative to the Values of Western Literary Tradition. It sounds pretty heavy, but Ben stresses that the original idea was really simple. It gets down to the importance of oral tradition, he said. Suddenly it occurred to me why fellow musicians refer to Ben as Dr. Jazz, a name taken from the old Jelly Roll Morton tune. Says Ben with a shrug, "Why not? I was running around with a PhD playing the piano." After returning to the States, Ben cut his first record for Capitol, Feel Your Groove. Unfortunately, nothing much happened promotion-wise, as the man who had brought him to Capitol got axed a few weeks later. Ben ruefully admits this to be a lucky in a way for a musician to get buried on his first album as he smiles. "Now I'm on a heavy philosophical trip. Just how naive was I? I forgot how important the first cut on the first side of a first album is. Mine was called Leo's My Name, and my voice was drowned out by the overdubbed people talking around the bar." He shakes his head in mock fury at himself. It should show that a musician can be his worst enemy. I'm going to move forward a little bit here, Ben, because I want you to hear this. What really bothers Ben is when people say, "Hey, you can't spread yourself too thin," to which Ben replies, "Bullshit. We are the common denominator of everything we do. People want you to go over the same hurdles that they do. If everything that I've tried ends up falling down on me, I look at it this way. It was mine to build, so it's mine to lose. That is my personal security." Speaking of security, many musical giants these days are worried about their commercial success among young people. Ben looks at the problem this way. Most musicians are not commercially successful because they don't understand the complexities of the music business. The thing with the music business is to always remember that it's 90% business and 10% music. Sidran says this matter-of-factly rather than cynically, the results of having paid his share of dues over the years. "There's a healthy elitism among musicians," he continues, "but for some guys, it's a defense mechanism. They say, 'I'm a musician, not a performer.' But even Coltrane had to sell records. And look at Mose. I mean, he's my hero, but he hasn't sold that many records, and he's made quite a few. Now that I'm becoming a performer, in addition to being a musician, I feel more complete. The thing is, performance is entertainment. Most true musicians play for their rhythm section and to their microphone rather than for an audience. There's a whole lot of rock musicians around who hit it big as performers, and now they've got to go back and learn their craft as musicians. As for the methods that many musical greats are looking to reach the younger audiences, Ben sums it up this way. What hurts me is when veteran musicians assess today's scene and feel forced to change their image, to be youth-oriented. I'm a bit skeptical when I see 50-year-old cats grow their sideburns and start dressing hip. That doesn't change their musical genius. What Charlie Mingus and Horace Silver did in their early 50s recordings has influenced popular music today. They've proved themselves as musicians. That should be enough. As for me, I would like to grow old gracefully and not have to worry about scrambling. And like Mose says, nobody has to justify himself. Trouble is, I've seen too many musicians worry about being passed up. And these are giants. I've told them, man, it just won't happen. You won't get passed up. There's no need for them to prove themselves to anybody. And I must admit that I feel a little out of line saying stuff like that, because I'm not really a kid, but I feel like one talking about Horace Silver. Our interview has come to a close, and suddenly Ben injects one last comment. Hey, someday I could find myself in the same situation, and you know what I'll say? Man, I don't have to justify anything to you.
Wow. First of all, I can't believe you just read that whole thing to me.
No, I skipped a bunch of it. It's even longer. You know why it's longer?
No. Because
it's the fucking cover story of Downbeat from 1974, the month of May. You never told me you were on the cover of Downbeat.
Who wrote it?
Dig this. Wait till you hear this shit. A young woman named Joan Levine wrote it.
Joan Ganage.
Joan Ganny. I received this article from a fan in Vancouver a month ago who was in a record store, and he said, "I found this copy of Downbeat with your dad on the cover of it." And I said, "I gotta see this." And he took pictures of it, and it's actually in the mail to me right now. I'm gonna have a physical copy of it. The cover of it is you, Michelle Legrand, Gil Evans, and the band Yes. It's their kind of R&B crossover issue. And Joan Levine is a 26-year-old aspiring journalist.
Yes.
In L.A., who is attracted to misfits and people who defy category, and she pitched you to Downbeat. You went over to her house, and as she describes it, she had no furniture at the time. She had just moved into the house. So you sat in the only chair that was there to sit in, which was, incredibly, the barber's chair that she had bought from Tommy in the Blue Thumb offices.
Wow.
Now, I have to figure out how to share... How am I going to send this? Well, maybe I'll just send it in the chat so you can see. Because then she found photos of you the day that you're being interviewed.
Huh. And this is 50 years ago.
53 years ago, which is why I think we may be celebrating your 53rd annual 30th birthday right now. Joan Ganich. Ganny. I asked her how she pronounced her name. Ganny, she said.
Oh, my goodness. I see the picture.
Yeah.
Oh, look at him.
Look at that guy.
Look at that guy. Well, he looks like a Charles Bukowski character. What do you think about that? What do you think about that picture and that guy?
What I think is incredible is how much is intact so early in your career. You're like four records in, deep enough in that you have experience and you've had your heart broken and you've had a certain amount of success and swagger. And at the same time, so little had happened. You know, you talk about Moe's. Little did you know that you would have this wonderful decades-long friendship and creative relationship with him. You talked about the importance of the oral tradition before you ever interviewed people. The name of the article, by the way, is The Weekend Starts Now, and it talks about how you were hosting a show in Madison on Thursday nights. So I am very moved by how much is there in you at that moment.
That's what struck me. How intact my worldview was and how I was like full sail, all sails to the wind. I was formed and here it is 112 years later. I stand by all of that.
Yeah.
It still is a pretty good summation of what followed, which I don't know if that's typical or normal, but it's kind of stunning to have gone so far and wound up just a few blocks away from where I started.
Well, right. So, and it raises a question in a way. It's like, okay, so do we get what we deserve? Do we live the life we set out to live? I mean, you kind of took that position early on and then everything kind of happened around it and with that being your point of view. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why leaving LA and moving to Madison turned out to suit you so well because it gave you a stance to take. You know, in LA or in New York, it's a little more based on opportunity. Like, you know, you're trying to get a hit. And so it's easy to forget what you stood for and why you stood for it in the first place. And then you talk about these 50-year-olds who changed the way they dress. You know, you never changed the way you dressed. You never changed your general vibe or your what you loved.
You know, the expression, you stand for something or you'll fall for anything. And I have a feeling that sentiment motivated me early on. There's something about music and me that I don't really understand intellectually, but I can see very clearly that what started out as the core to my experience wound up to be the core of my person. I've always said this, that you get involved with some things, like I was involved with this music, and you become literally, physically a different person. I think maybe that's true. I think if you listen to Horace Silver every day for 10 years, your entire endocrine system has been remodeled. And you're literally not the same person. It's kind of stunning to hear that. I mean, I'm not looking back at all at that time or that guy, but I am kind of gobsmacked that I not only knew so much about my own past, but I predicted my own future.
In many ways, you did. So I was communicating. Joan Ganny is a friend of ours. She lives in Amsterdam, and I'm in touch with her at least on a monthly basis. And I happened to have been in communication with her yesterday. And then this morning, I started to do research into Joan Levine, who wrote this article. and I discovered that there's a moment in the mid-70s when Joan Levine becomes Joan Ganney. And I wrote to her and I said, did you write a cover story on Downbeat on my father? And meanwhile, Amanda's going in the background going, I think we already knew this. And Joan was so excited that we got on a Zoom. And actually, I'll probably run a little bit of that interview at the end of this interview, because she was cute and she was cool. You know, she was on the scene. She talked to everybody. She yeah. was really hip. And she said, Lawrence Ferlinghetti once told her, poetry is prophecy. And she said, and Ben is one of our great prophets, which is a very deeply beautiful thing to say, because she's also saying you're one of our great poets. But she's saying, you know, she felt even back then that what you were singing about. And it's funny, because I go back and I think some of those lyrics are among your, honestly, that your thinnest lyrics compared to what came after. But she said he was singing about our generation. He was singing about me. Even something as simple as when a woman says she's ready, she said it was part of the sexual awakening of a young woman in the early 70s to be able to talk about things like that and in those terms. That you were of that time and of that moment. And man, I look at this photo of you. You're 20 years younger than I am in this photo. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost kind of to the day. And you look like a kid.
I did not feel like a kid. I really didn't. Having gone through the music and the 60s, the school and the anti-war and England and L.A., you know, it was kind of a joke to say, well, I never thought I'd live to be 30. But there was a time when we actually felt that. I don't think that's the case today. I think everybody assumes they're going to live to 90. You know, everybody's looking at longevity. But back then, we really, in some ways, we were very naive. And in some ways, I think we grew up fast. And I think that I particularly, as kind of an outsider, I mean, I was never part of any organization that would have me. I was never particularly political. I was never particularly academic. Well, you know, my whole idea of first degree searchers, which is some people are called and they don't know why they're called. They don't even know what they're called for. But when they are out and about and they run into somebody else that has been called, they recognize them.
Well, this was my conversation with Joan today, because I said, Joan, I got to tell you something. I don't know what to make of this other than that you and I are members of the same tribe. But I also wonder, Ben, one thing I do feel in that interview, and that I often feel when I read and see documents of you, is that you were serious. You know, later on, you started to talk about how important the hang was. It's all about the hang and how important the humor of, even if it's gallows humor or whatever, the humor among musicians was. I don't feel that from you here. And it is not lost on me that this is a conversation that you're having a few years after having lost your father and a few years before becoming a father yourself. And you are in this middle space where shit is serious.
Yes. And I think it's sort of like focused down, the lens has been focused because of the situation I was in. By this point, I was probably on my third record label or whatever, and I was really in the midst of it. But I remember Harvey Kornspan, when he was still Steve Miller's manager, said to me about those days, he said exactly the same thing. He said, well, we were all on playtime, but you were serious.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel that. Huh. So I guess, like we say, you know, jazz is serious fun. If you're not having fun, you're not being serious. I think I just happened to manifest that early on. I mean, you know, when I was 13, I was stopped by the police for stealing a car. That's not something you would assume that guy who did that interview would have in his portfolio of experiences. I mean, I was kind of not one thing or another. And I think that was always my strength. And it was clearly one of the reasons why to this day I remain somewhat obscure and hard to pin down, hard to put a pin in, hard to label. And, you know, if you can't define a thing, you can't really sell it. and you can't dispense with it. And so I've been kind of enigmatic, but not to myself. It all, to me, comes back to, I always cared a lot. Caring. I mean, not about any one particular thing. Well, you know my whole feeling about this, that language fails us, that we label emotions. Oh, I'm afraid, I'm happy, I'm sad. But those are just made up labels. At bottom, there's just caring. There's just the feeling of revolving around the sun, as I wrote in the lyrics, without floor, without ceiling, without malice for anyone. There's something in that idea that I think I've been floating on. I think I've been floating on this emotional sense, and I think music has been my way of accessing it.
The idea of somebody playing an interview for me that I did 30 years ago when I was 20, or 20 years ago when I was 30, would be very scary to me. One of the lessons I think I take from this is, you know, every time you open your mouth, it's there. It's a wonderful document, but it's a brutal document for the future. And so it matters what we say. We should be thoughtful about what we say. And you kind of live in this weird cut between that impulse to just throw it down, whatever it is, and move on, and to be real serious about everything, you know, to take it seriously. And that's a hard, that I'm still kind of grappling with it, to be honest with you, because it's like, it's not that anything goes, but it is sort of like you're never going to be more prepared for this moment than you are right now. And you have to find the kind of the space in between those two ideas.
All our best efforts got us right here, right now. I mean, I'm a big believer. There are no big moments and little moments. There are just moments, and each one has the weight of the past and the future in it. And I don't know where that comes from. Part of what I hear when you read that to me, I hear a kid overcoming some kind of hurt. There's a deep hurt in there.
I hear it too. And as a matter of fact, for the first 10 years of your recording career, I felt you were hurt. You were somewhat defensive. You made it clear that you were smart and you understood the business, and that the business was skewed, and you know, I mean, you talked about that a lot, so that must have meant that something had hurt you about it. Confronting maybe the idea when you finally became a professional full-time musician that it was a business, that it could let you down. You know, maybe all those times you listened to Blue Mitchell, you know, it hadn't dawned on you that there was a contract somewhere in there, you know.
Right. The business was clearly a source of hurt after a very few years, because I just happened to walk into the business when it was like a cauldron. It was boiling and changing so fast, and the amount of energy and money and cultural capital that was being spent, it really was hard to keep your feet on any kind of ground. But at the same time, it feels to me that maybe all of us are trying to justify, trying to emotionally understand what happened to us before we were sentient enough to really pick it apart.
I mean, I think you may have just made the case for psychotherapy.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, Sonny Rollins said if people listened to jazz, it would change them totally, and jazz could save the world. So just exchange the word jazz for psychotherapy.
Do you have to stay up on the news of the day in order to be a contemporary person?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The news of the day is virtually irrelevant, because all those conversations and issues have been around for thousands of years. It's not the news of the day. It's the experience of us on this planet.
So how do we feel the experience shifting over time if it's not tied to the daily churn of the latest news or whatever's happening politically or culturally or what's in the charts or whatever? How do you feel time moving? Like, obviously, life feels very much the way it did in 1974 and very much not the way it did in 1974.
This goes to entropy and noise. I mean, quite frankly, there's an arc to our life and our experience. And as you know, I think it's so nuts that, first of all, anybody would want to live forever or live to 120, but would make that the goal of something. So what? You get another 20 years? You're going to be forgotten. I'm going to be forgotten. It all goes to dust, you know? So that's not the mission. The mission is not longevity. And entropy is the issue. You know, not just entropy in your physical infrastructure, which is inevitable, but entropy in your emotional condition, entropy in your hopes and dreams, and entropy in your empathy. There you go. The entropy in your empathy. That's a big one. That's a big one.
Well, you know, going back also to the hopes and dreams and then into the empathy too, you know, that's what I find myself wondering when I read that article about you from 1974. Like, what do you think that man was dreaming of? What came true? What didn't? What happened instead?
Mm-hmm. Well, as my man Moe said, if you want to make your own breakthrough, you're going to have to lose a few. What didn't come true? Gee, an awful lot of ideas that I believed in didn't come to pass. Awful lot. One thing that turned out to be true is that if you practice, you get better. I mean, I'm practicing piano today. Oh, and this goes to Horace Silver. This is really cool. So, you know, I've had Horace Silver's tunes in my head for more than 65 years. One of them was Sister Sadie. Sister Sadie sounds simple in my head. Recently, I'm thinking of recording Sister Sadie on this solo piano record. So I've had to kind of focus on it and learn it. And God damn it, if I never really understood the song. I heard it and I liked it, but it turns out if you slow down and drill down and practice, the little nuances emerge, and it's those nuances that make something what it is. And to be able to discover that,
yeah,
and to know that that's going to be there for you is a great motivation to slow down. Yeah. It's a great motivation to keep up.
That is the antidote to entropy.
Thank you. Yes, well put. I feel that. Entropy is inevitable, but the antidote is available.
But I like that the antidote is deceptive in that it comes for you, at least in this moment, in slowing down and understanding that if you slow down, there's all this stuff there for you to find.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's where people naturally run off track. The assumption that you understand something. The assumption that because you like it or you care about it or you're familiar with it or it's part of your life, that you actually understand it.
Yeah.
Two different things. And I think that's true about relationships too. You know, we get into these relationships with people and things and places, and our assumption is based on our past experience, everything's rolling along and we know what's going on. When every time we see each other, it's different, it's new. We can't assume. We should listen more than we talk, which is not my strong point, unfortunately.
That's interesting. You think it's not your strong point?
I hear myself talk a lot. And you know my theory that I know what I think when I hear what I say. And I think that's true about all of us. How else can we know what we think unless we hear it expressed?
Well, I mean, you have the benefit of not being super famous, and so this doesn't happen to you all the time. But I do think that you live in a world where quite often people listen when you talk. So once again, it's sort of like, it's hard to just, you know, fire off a bunch of trivial shit.
Well, you know, you listen when I talk, and I find that a gift and also a challenge because I don't want to waste your time. At the same time, your mother listens while I talk, but she hears something entirely different.
Well, I mean, what I am after, I think, through, I have decided in this very moment, through this ongoing series of conversations with you. Number one, tracking a person, a relationship over time. you know, it's very interesting. I think it'd be very interesting to go back and hear what your 75th birthday conversation was like. What were we talking about? Is it different? Is it the same? Has it deepened? Has it changed? That in and of itself is interesting. Also, our dynamic is always fun, and that's cool. But then maybe the third thing is, like, is it possible to be surprised by someone that you know so well? Is it possible to go deeper? It's like when we play music. It's like, it's always the same. It's always different. It doesn't go deeper necessarily. It's every now and then we catch something, but it doesn't, like, deepen it in some profound way. But I guess that's part of the question, is it possible to find surprise through this? And I will say, like, I was surprised by this article. Part of the reason I was surprised by it was because you're on the cover of Downbeat. And I do feel that when we talk about the disappointments or the things that didn't come to you, again, you walk a fine line between enormous humility and gratitude for being invited to the table, for a seat at the table, and also a sense that for whatever reason, maybe because you didn't pick a lane, maybe because you didn't pick a coast, maybe because you didn't allow yourself to be really produced by other people or even managed by anybody, for whatever reason, you didn't get a lot of the sort of rewards from the community that you in many ways sort of served for so many years. But here is your name on the cover of Downbeat, which is one of those rites of passage, and it happened super early.
When you tell me you talked to Rufus Reed and he said to say hi, that's it for me, man. Rufus Reed said to say hi. Hey, Rufus. Yeah, man.
They light up. They always light up. As you know, I saw Rufus Reed last night and Joe LaBarbera, and they both lit up at hearing your name. And they both, how is he? How's he doing, man?
So I have succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. And as I told you and Judy years ago, look, if my plane ever goes down, don't feel bad for me, man. It's been much better than I ever anticipated. I think it's because I'm an American. And in America, we don't take time to enjoy and appreciate life. We struggle against economic forces, and we find our worth in our bank accounts, and it's not possible to be totally indifferent. I mean, you would hope it would be, and all the study and all the understanding you may have leads you to believe that that's dross. And at the same time, if you were raised in America, man, it's in the air.
I think it may be attached to social mobility, because I think that there's a certain acceptance. So many of my friends in Europe really seem to be at peace with wherever they are sort of in the socioeconomic strata. And I think it's because that shit goes back generations. And so there's not really an expectation that through any work of your own, you would die a richer man or a much poorer man than you how you were when you were born. And here, the narrative is all self-made. And so the idea is it's on you, incumbent upon yourself and and all of that stuff that you describe. It's your success or yours to win or to lose.
Yeah, Calvinism. But, you know, what's ironic is I recently read that social mobility in the United States lags behind a lot of Western European countries, that in fact, social mobility in the United States is more difficult than it would be in Denmark or Sweden or France. And so even though the past is looms so much larger and it might be seen as an encumbrance, in fact, the United States, let's face it, is not as it was sold.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bait and switch going on here.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because we made it all up. I mean, and that's been a big part of the stories that you've been telling is we made it up. And weren't these cats great who made it up? But guess what, Dave? It was all made up.
It was all made up.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, though. I do think one thing that, even though there's been a lot of bait and switch in America, one thing that... And we've already done our America episode this summer, by the way, so we don't have to belabor this.
No, but we don't have to belabor anything.
But it is clear that something that is true here is if you have a good idea, you know,
yes,
that'll carry you.
You can run with them. That's true.
An idea will carry you here. And that is not always the case. And that has been your American experience, I think.
It totally has. And it goes back to my very first idea. My first idea and maybe perhaps my best idea was the premise of Black Talk, was the premise that there is something in the music and in the Black experience and in the oral tradition that was a radical alternative to everything that came before in America. And it captured a generation, if not generations, of people and transformed it and created backlash and everything. It's like the pebble in the lake. The rings go out in all directions. There's no linear history. But that idea of experiencing life through your ears rather than through your eyes was really powerful. Yeah. And to this day, I think, if anything about me survives, I think that's going to be what survives. The fact that so many Black historians
yes.
are favorable about that book tells me I'm Black too.
You know, you said something today, and again, I think talking about tracking conversations over time, you said something today that does, in a way, point to an evolving position, and that is nobody's going to remember us. It all turns to dust.
Yeah.
The idea that we will all be forgotten is either your response to a changing media yeah. landscape and an understanding that there was no way when you were younger and allowing the mantra to be let history decide, I'm right. going to make this work and we shall see what's valuable and what isn't over time.
Yes.
But you were not able to predict the flood, the fire hose, the waterfall of content that would be thrust upon us, and then AI, which exponentially adds to that. So there is almost no way to really cut through or know that anything that you've ever done will survive, because you can just feel what we're up against. It could be that, or it could be the quiet acceptance of the fact that actually none of that really did matter. Not really.
What you just said, which I like, is that it's not the lack of access, it's the surfeit of access that's the threat to our happiness. I am so happy that at this moment I'm not in pain. Let me just say that.
Mm.
You know, the lack of having pain is such a wonderful thing. We don't think about that until we've experienced pain. And when we're young, we want everything to be better and greater and success and money and everything. But as we get older, what we want is normal. What's normal? How can I get yeah. back to normal? Who was there when it was normal? What was I when it was normal?
When does it start and when does it stop? What are the edges of normal?
What are the edges of normal? Well, as I always wind up sitting here talking to you, this is my normal, man. What we're doing here, we've been doing for 50 years. And people think I'm speaking metaphorically when I say that, but I'm not. I've been hanging with you since before you had language.
Yeah.
And I found you.
I probably made a lot more sense back then.
You were very accessible. Yeah. As a toddler, you really were. You communicated wonderfully and we had a great time. So this is what I've got, man. You know, all those ideas and years and hopes and whatever, the chaos, and that's a cliche too, but this is what you have in the end.
Exactly. This right here is what you have in the end. So then, you know, one question is, if you knew that this is the conclusion that you were going to come to, would you have hustled so hard? Would you have worked so hard?
Oh, I personally think I had the perfect amount of hustle. I needed that hustle to stay afloat. And at the same time, I had a lot of time when I just was listening and hanging and having a great time. I don't think I did anything to my detriment at all. I think that by being true to something and always having that as a sign before my eyes, I think I did right.
I mean, it is incredible, Ben. Nobody ever makes any real point of listing your vast limitations.
Right.
You know, they
they don't talk about that.
They don't talk about it.
Isn't that funny? Isn't that funny?
So I don't know what you did, but everybody's always talking about all the shit you got together, and they don't notice.
Well, that's the magic act, isn't it? I mean, if you only got two cards, you play them.
And then they say he's a Renaissance man, and I, you know, and here I am. I'm just like trying to do 16 careers at the same time, and somehow I can't figure out how to take an afternoon and hang. And that's interesting, you know. And I think of it as the curse of being able to do all these things, you know. But it's also, it is in a way, because it's like it's hard to choose.
Well, that's right. Said another way, my limitations have been my advantage. And I'm sorry you're not as limited as I am. It's painful for you, but there you are.
It's killing me.
It's killing you. I know. But your work is killing me, man. I just so love your work. I can't tell you. First of all, because I understand where it comes from. But second of all, it's so good, man. Your songs, your conversations, your parenting. I hate the word parenting. I hate taking a noun and making it a verb, but I mean it. I mean, you're going to, I think, live to feel the same sort of acceptance.
Well, you know, you do say in this article, and it made me so happy. You know, obviously, we could always have a little more money in the bank, and we could always be a little more famous, and we could all have an extra Grammy. And there's a lot of things that I want for you still. But you say, I would like to grow old gracefully and not have to worry about scrambling. And that has come true.
Yes.
And you say, I want to be able to be at the later part of my life and say, I don't have to justify anything. You know, and you say, and you know what I'll say, man, I don't have to justify anything to you. And if there's anybody you would ever have to justify anything to, I suppose it might be me, and you don't have to justify anything to me.
Mm-hmm. I know, you know me too well. There's no slipping and sliding there, man. Which has also really been a blessing, the fact that I chose early on to be transparent.
Yeah, that is, I think that is, well, you are after a kind of authenticity in this interview that I think is exactly right. And frankly, I don't even think you knew your true authentic self at that time.
No.
But you understood the importance of finding it and representing it.
That used to be so important. And now it's just sort of a vestige of some previous time. But authenticity, you know, as they say in the gospel church, living the song you sing about, that was everything.
Well, man, I just want to close by also celebrating the fact that in this interview from 1974, you talk about the first song on the first record that you ever made.
Yes.
The song was called Leo's My Name, Music's My Business. Nobody ever really heard the song because you buried it under a bunch of chatter.
Yep.
And
threw it away. Totally threw it away. Didn't know what I had.
Didn't know what you had in that tune. And meanwhile, hired like Harry Shearer and a bunch of LA actors to
Christopher Guest act
like they were drunk at a bar.
Yep.
And somewhere in the back of that mix is you playing and singing Leo's My Name, Music My Business. It was recorded 5 years before I was born, or 6 years. When was that? 70? 1970?
Yep.
6 years before I was born. The more I think about it, I think there's nothing more magical beyond the idea that you like the name Leo. So first you wrote a song, Leo's My Name, Music's My Business, and then you made a child, called him Leo. Music is my business. And I'm happy to say now, here first, this is not, we're not going to speak about this again for a couple more months when I formalize the announcement. So it's only for those who are with us listening. My new record, my 10th solo album, is going to come out next year. It's called Leo's My Name, and I'm opening that record with my version of your song, Leo's My Name.
I could not be happier. If there's anything that is a birthday present for me, that's it. I can't tell you how happy that makes me.
It's so cool. I feel like I've been working up to it my whole life. Anyway, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Ben. Yet another one for the history books here today.
Well, as I say to you every year, you know, make me sound good.
I got you. Oh, so a couple things. I'll play 5 minutes of my conversation with Joan Ganney because it was just so fun to talk to her and hear her memory of meeting you and what that was like back then. And also, because I'm not going to do any fancy footwork on this episode, third-story.com is a place to go visit the archive, including every birthday going back at least 8 years with you, Ben. Also, the Substack, leosidran.substack.com. I'm on there all the time now. That's like my new hang.
Nice.
And WBGO.org, because we are made in partnership with WBGO. And I'm going to give you one more opportunity to do this. You didn't get it right last time. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then.
I'll see you soon. I'll see you later. No, until then, keep listening. What?
I'll talk to you soon.
I'll talk to you soon.
Leo.
Joan.
Wow.
What a trip. So did I know this? I know this already.
Well, I think I had told you a few years ago and sent some of the color pictures that I'd taken of Ben. But I'm so curious how in the world you tracked this Joan Levine down, because I've been trying to track some of my old interviews and I don't know how to be detective enough, I guess.
Well, the first thing is somebody in Vancouver, Canada, found a physical copy of this issue of Downbeat. Yeah. And took a picture of the cover and said, look what I found. Somebody who listens to the podcast and said, look what I found. And I said, I would love to read that article, you know. And so he went back the next week and he bought it and he took pictures of it and sent it to me. And I thought, well, this is great because every year for Ben's birthday, I do something special. This is like such a wonderful time capsule. And also he talks about aging musicians in his conversation with you. What he thinks is an appropriate way to age in the music. And maybe one day he'll be a person who can say, I have nothing to answer for. You know, I did what I did.
Yep.
So what more appropriate time capsule to revisit for his 83rd birthday than to go back to 1974 and read him this thing. And then my intention is to read it to him and then without telling him when it's from or what it is and see what that stirs up in him. But okay, but now here's Joan Levine. And I'm thinking, who is this writer? Like, who wrote this thing? And I started doing some research on the internet and I found Joan Levine's career up until about 1977. Some Downbeat pieces, San Diego radio.
Yeah.
And then it disappears. And so this is when I turned to AI in ChatGPT. Can you find me information about this writer, Joan Levine? Is it a married name? Did she change her name? And it says, oh, yes, I tracked it down and it seems that Joan Levine is Joan Ganisch.
Really?
And I jumped. I jumped in my seat. And here I am talking to the robot saying, I know her.
I mean, like I say, an hour or 2 hours ago, I was updating my address book and I realized on the S page, I hadn't filled them in yet. So I transferred you first because I'd seen your number yesterday. And then I get this mail from you. I'm just blown away because I love stuff like this, you know.
The world, something's happening vibrationally in the world where we're all.
And I've had this secret dream because, you know, I had this wonderful radio show when I moved to LA called Off the Record.
Yeah.
And I was interviewing like everybody, talking about everything but what was on the record. We launched Born to Run on my show, and I did a petition campaign for John Lennon. I thought, Leo is doing all the stuff I used to do and love, and that's why I'm such a fangirl to you, because I love your stuff. You know, I mean, you know, I adore you, but I always learn stuff. I get turned on to things, and I thought, my secret dream, because I miss radio so much, and what are we doing, podcasts or the old radio, you know, with. And I thought, I would love to be on your show someday, but never imagined it at all.
Okay, so Joan, so tell me, I guess, since we're here.
Yes.
Who was Joan Levine in 1974, and how did you find yourself doing this piece on Ben?
I was 20-something in 1974. I was also a young mom and a university student and married, putting a husband through law school and marching for the women's movement.
Wait, tell me again, how old were you?
I was 26.
26.
I just had started writing in San Diego. I had started the San Diego State College paper. I was bored out of my mind in a zoology class, and they said the newspaper needed reviewers. I thought, oh, what a cool way to get concert tickets. So slowly breaking in the college newspaper. Then we had in San Diego a very hip paper that was a underground paper called The Door. I started writing for them because they didn't pay us, but we got 50 albums a week because they got all the promos. And they brought a young kid to me there one day who was 15 and said, could you take him along on your B.B. King interview? I said, I don't want some teenager hanging out. And it was Cameron Crowe. And Cameron and I became buddies because he liked all the stuff that I didn't like. You know, he was into Led Zeppelin and I was more into James Taylor or, you know, Carole King and Crosby, Stills. And it was just perfect. So he and I were kind of buddies. And that film, Almost Famous, is just so nostalgic because it's just, I mean, he's amazing. And it was wonderful to have those times back then. And meanwhile, I wrote an article for The Door about the cool FM radio stations. And the program director at the number one station in San Diego said to me one day, you have a great voice. And I said, really? I said, I've always been self-conscious because I pronounce everything so clearly. He said, no, have you ever thought about radio? I said, I've dreamed about radio. I got my FCC license and all of that and became the first female DJ on KPRI. Breaking in again, well, from the college paper and The Door, I thought I'm going to try the LA Times. And Chuck Chamblin, who was the film critic there, mentored me. And my first interview was, I think it was Bette Midler, The Last E is Silent, you know, stuff like that. And then I thought, I want to write about jazz. I'm going to try Downbeat. So that was just the kind of thing in those days. Everything was possible. And you just tried it, you know. I had a friend and I said, I want to write for Esquire. And he said, well, he said, that's good, but he said, there's a ladder. And he said, you're on the ladder, you're climbing it up, and go step by step, because if you try and you skip all those middle steps, you might reach Esquire, maybe you'll do something, but you're going to fall down, so do it steady.
Yes.
I never got into Esquire, but I did get into Penthouse, and in those days, the men's magazines paid so well. Yeah. So I was writing about Henry Miller and Joan Baez and Bruce Dern and, you know, the oddballs. I like writing about quirky people that weren't so known. And okay, coming full circle, how I discovered Ben.
Yeah.
I discovered him, I think, from a slush pile at KPRI. I think I saw this and I thought, what's going on here? And I thought I had heard his name involved with the Steve Miller, but not really. And it was interesting because he spoke to me, you know, like Chances Are and When a Woman Says She Ready. It was all about stuff of my sexual awakening, really, in beginning 30s. I mean, truly, that was our kind of our jam music, you know. It was just lots of stuff that Ben was speaking, writing about. It crossed all kinds of borders into what was going on. And I met and knew Lawrence Ferlinghetti pretty well years ago, the poet, and he told me once, poetry is prophecy. And I look at Ben's lyrics and I think, Ben has been a prophet.
I will say, reading your interview with my father from 1974, I do feel, this is for me to talk about with him, but I do feel that it is a wonderful window into who he was before he became a father. I was born 2 years later. He's still a young man proving himself in a certain way. Of course, you were even younger, so to you, he seemed like he was this adult maybe or something. But
grown up.
Did you do the interview in San Diego? Did you go to Madison? Was it in L.A.?
No, it was in L.A. I was living in L.A. then. We had moved back because we were students in San Diego. So we moved back to L.A. And that's when I also had this talk show on K-West Radio called Off the Record. But in 74, I wanted to get into Downbeat. And I realized Ben would be ideal for that. And I knew the guys at Blue Thumb, mainly Bob Krasno. I got to meet Tommy later by the bobber chair. But I used to go over there to the offices and we were talking. Then I realized Ben would be ideal because I like quirky people and also people that weren't that known yet or were known in certain circles but needed to be more known. And I was very green. Ben was living in Madison at the time. So he came to my house. We lived in Westwood. And you know, we had a very funky kind of house in an old Spanish bungalow building, very nice house, but we didn't have furniture yet. So we just had all these pillows, you know, like you would do, kind of hippie Indian bedspread things. But I had this barber chair, I think, and I think he sat in that, which was weird because it was tummies, you know, but we didn't talk about that. But at any rate, I remember being very nervous, like, oh my gosh, I'm bringing somebody into my home and will it be okay? And how do I do this? And all of that. So I really did my homework, you know, and I had my notes and I had two young children and they were, you know, not home yet. So, you know, you're balancing all these things. And I remember, and was pleasant surprise, he was shy, isn't the right word, but he was very low key. I used to interview lots of, I mean, everybody, and sometimes the macho, I mean, people like, well, going to interview Isaac Hayes once for, I forget which magazine, maybe it was Cosmopolitan, and he opened the door wearing just red Speedos. You know, this was way before Me Too, and who, I don't think he was up to anything, but still, as a young woman, I thought, do I go into that Beverly Hills mansion? And I had a mom that had been a glamour photographer, so she always taught me, you know, like, just go for the job, be professional. So I wasn't wearing mini skirts and all of that, even though that's what everybody did. I was really, you know, trying to be very professional. But I remember I thought, I got to do something, and I'm not sure what, but I got to do something. I remember, Mr. Hayes, I'm so sorry. I obviously arrived too early. I'll wait while you finish getting dressed. And you know, he did it. He came back and it was cool. You know, and it was just all about, I mean, but again, and I want to come right back to Ben, this was interesting times for young women because it was a man's world also. Some of the guys at Downbeat were really challenging and, you know, being the only really woman writer at that time there and also being, you know, covering Muhammad Ali, being the only woman writer there in the camp and no interviews and, you know, having to say, well, he has to have time for an interview. What does he do? And he trains. And I said, well, I can run because I was running and it was, I ran with Ali every day on the golf course to get the interview. So with Ben, it was such a pleasure because I was not intimidated, but I really felt I needed to show him that I'd done my homework and that it was going to be a good interview. And so I think it turned into this lovely conversation, which I just read the article again about an hour ago. And I thought, wow, you know, this was good. I mean, because it was one of my early pieces. So I'm very proud of it. And I just remember him forthcoming. I think he saw I was sincere, loved the music, dug it as much as I could at that young age, but still the feel of it. I think my sense of him was he was kind of a musician's musician. I love that Dr. Jazz thing because that also seemed to say everything, like, I'll fix it. I'll be the producer, or I'll be the engineer, I'll be the arranger. I'm the man of many hats, but I got it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make it better.
Yeah, I think you really captured him and he revealed himself to you. I really see him. I mean, I think if you took, if you stripped the names out of that article, I would know, oh, that's my dad. That's a conversation with my father. He was serious. I think he was a serious guy. I mean, he was funny. He's always been funny, but I think I can feel that he's serious. When he's talking about the lack of nostalgia for the 50s and the idea that rock and roll was trivial to him and sort of light music was not interesting to him for the longest time, he didn't take it seriously. You feel how serious he had been.
Oh, yeah. And then the whole fact of him going off to Sussex. I mean, who did that then?
Well, and interestingly, here we are talking, and you, as long as I've known you, you've lived in Amsterdam. You've been a proper American expatriate as long as I've known you.
Have you?
At the time, you were this California girl, and he was the one who was back from England. Now here you know, you ended up spending a big part of your life abroad. When do you think you crossed paths with him again after that?
That was in 74. I crossed paths with him in San Diego at the Blue Door Bookstore when he was doing this signing. I have to remember, I guess I'm seeing if there's a date in Black Talk. Then after that, I ran into him again when he did that other book in the 90s. And we kind of, and the thrill of my life was having dinner with him and Judy a few years ago in Amsterdam. Finally meeting her because I just knew what a muse she was for him. And I thought, you know, women recognize each other. And I thought, you know, when I had seen a picture of her once on an album, and I thought, wow, you know, just the soul and the muse, the energy. Yeah, you know, and
Joan, so happy to see you and so happy to hear some of this story. And I'll find a way to sneak you into the episode somehow. You're going to make an appearance, I'm sure of it.
Oh, well, it would be an honor, but I will also understand as a good editor that sometimes less is more.
Fantastic. Right.
Love to everybody.
Love to you, Joan. So happy to see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.